Good afternoon. Rap News is back online. Today we take on and analyze one of the most intractable, divisive, ongoing violent divides to happen in our time. The 60-year conflict going on betwixt Israel and Palestine. Is there a one-state, two-state, or no straight solution to this protracted fight? From Camp David to Madrid, to Harbor to Oslo, for decades back in time, all peace talks have devolved into violent rows, and roadmaps to peace have led nowhere but more war. Until now! Welcome to the first Middle East Peace Raps. This afternoon, Rap News is proud of this tremendous chance to prove the peace-filled art of rap could chart the best roadmap to start anew. So first up, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Shalom. BB been ready this whole time to engage the peace process with war crimes. I mean raw rhymes.
Alright, well, we'd like to bring the whole story to light. Please begin by telling us Israel's side. How did this war arise?
The fact is, my people have suffered awful tragedies. Centuries of persecution, diaspora. We were slaughtered, massacred. In the shore, Hitler tried to have us wiped off the map, and thus we sought a safe harbor, a place to gather us. Some told us, go to Argentina. Others, go to Uganda. But we said, go f*** yourselves. And like Exodus, we came back to our biblical homeland, Eretz Israel, which the Lord handed us. And then in 1948, we declared the birth of the Jewish state.
Your people have indeed suffered massively, unimaginably, and should have sanctuary, not just in the Middle East, but wherever they happen to be. However, isn't the Holy Land holy also to Christians and Muslims? How can you claim that only Jews own the land and exclude them?
With the Six-Day War, we fulfilled our Zionist covenant, invaded Jerusalem, the West Bank, Golan and Gaza, taking all of it.
The occupied territories.
Then on the seventh day, we rested, and when all the world's nations witnesses great event, they
condemned it?
What?
It seems the UN issued Resolution 242, calling on Israel to give back those territories and withdraw troops.
Hey, hey, are you denying the legitimacy of the Jewish state?
I'm just trying to...
Anti-Semites!
Wait, what?
Everybody, these guys are Nazi!
Okay, okay, just let's relax.
Jew hater!
We've yet to ask the rival party. We now cross direct to Gaza to check the raps of a Palestinian spokesperson representing Hamas.
Salam! As you can see, we are ready to talk peace, but only within the 1967 borders will we recognize Israel and sign deals.
Oh yeah? Recognize this.
Kapow!
A mess? Now he looks more like hummus. What a mess.
Mr. Netanyahu, you killed him.
I guess. But it was in self-defense.
No, it wasn't.
Yes, it was. Yes. Check out the news coverage from the US.
I'm Brian Washington. You're on MSNBS. Tonight's headlines: peace process shattered yet again by unprovoked attacks from Arab terrorists. Israel retaliates with airstrikes in self-defense. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Palestinian suicide homes are ramming themselves into peaceful Israeli bulldozers. Israel is under threat, which is why, as shown on this map, its settlements have, steadily expanded. How can we end this injustice? To explain, we welcome John Kerry, Secretary of State.
Great to be back, Bucky.
And don't you stress a bit. American taxpayers have got Israel covered till Armageddon hits. No country gets more U.S. foreign aid sent to it. $140 billion since the 70s. Plus military weaponry. No conditions or strings with it.
No conditions at all?
Well, we would prefer it better if they could kindly stop using our money to build new illegal settlements.
What did you say, you schmuck?
Baby! Oh, no, I was just telling
them. Just keep sending the money, Schmickele.
Yes, sir. We'll write the check. Wait, we're getting a call from some Jewish guy in Brooklyn. He's on the line with us.
An American Jew? He's bound to be pro-Zionist. Let him speak.
Hello, MSNBS?
Yes, you're on the screen.
This is Norman Finkelstein, ringing in to state the truth in this case. Israel is a lunatic state. It's no excuse to steal Palestinian land because Jews suffered genocide at Hitler's hands.
A self-hating Jew. Everybody, this guy's an Ashkenazi.
Shut up, BB. And I also condemn American policy of funding the theft of Palestinian territory.
Okay, Funkelstein, we get the gist of all this. Now, where were we? Financing war crime.
That's a straight fact.
Well done, America.
Thank APEC. They got us by the tank sacks. We have to wave that Star of David flag.
But it's worth paying cash to have Israel's back.
That's true. They're the only nation in the Muslim backwoods that shares our American values.
Give us some examples.
We both love trampling international law.
Constantly. We're both nuclear states and democracies.
With terrorist foreign policies.
And obviously,
both America and Israel.
We're built by occupying territories of native peoples.
We're both settler colonies.
Awesome. Publicity time. Keep your eyes on the screen.
Hey, I'm Scarlett Johansson, and my real job is promoting illegal occupations. It's easy. You start by taking other people's land and water, send in Zionist settlers, push the natives out of their homes, causing bloodshed. And look, settlers dream. Better for Israel and all of us.
ScarJo,
looks delicious, and what's more, it reminds me of our very own sponsor, Redskin Genocider. Flavor of the American nation,
bloody good.
Tasteful.
So, Israel is a settler colony, like Canada, America, and
Australia!
Our colonial assessor is in the area. Does Israel pass the test, Kenovka?
Kenovka? Yeah! I'm in Jerusalem!
And what's going on over there?
I'm celebrating the day of Israel's birth, Yom Hetzmaut, which roughly translates to Australia Day. And wow, it's like back home, barbies, flags, beers. So in solidarity, I got the end of me knob chopped off. It's patriotic, apparently.
What do Palestinians make of this day?
I don't know, eh?
Perhaps you should ask them.
Okay, I'll ask the natives. Wait.
Oi! Hello! Can you hear me?
Salam!
Hey! How do you celebrate this wonderful day?
We natives participate with smiling face in this party, mate. Just like your Aboriginal people on Invasion Day.
And I was cast out from the lands of my mom and my father. Now I dance as an outcast to the bombs over Gaza.
Hina du yom el istiklal, hina bin nadin nakba.
And we sing Israel, your independence is our nakba.
Sounds great. I love a party with a snack bar.
Not a snack bar, Crocodile Dundee.
Nakba.
It means a catastrophe.
Anti-Semitic.
It's far from truth. We are far from home. Zionism is far from Jews. How can I explain it to you? We lost our rights that day.
And our barbecues.
No barbies. That's a tragedy. How can we help you?
BDS يعني مقاطعة هاي الطريقة اللي بيستجم في تل أبيب زي اللي استجم في جنوب أفريقيا. ساعدنا نوقف جنون المستوطن. ساعدنا نبني دولة فيها شوية منطق. مش دولة اليهود
بل دولة لليهود
للمسيحية للمسلمين ليوسي لعبود لجيريس
ولميل جيبسون.
What the fuck شو خاص ميل جيبسون؟
Well, it seems that despite the use of rap and rhyme, we failed to seal a real peace deal between Israel and Palestine. Nevertheless, I hope we've expanded our minds and are prepared to share some final thoughts before we wrap for the night. This might seem like some battle entwining other people in another time, but in fact, it mirrors back our own greatest challenge to live side by side, no matter race, flags, or which invisible man we pray to in the sky. And that is why there'll be peace nowhere until there's peace in Palestine. The war is over, if we want it, to borrow Lenin's line. It was pressure from outside that ended the crime of apartheid that turned terrorists into winners of the Peace Prize. The question is, can we learn history's lessons and apply them in our time? When we analyze our direction, it's clear where the answers lie. Does any state hold the power to change the tide? Or is the one safe solution for us to unify rather than divide? Not just in the Middle East, but globally, far and wide. Good night.
From under the Iron Dome, here at Pacifica Radio in Houston, this is the Inner Side radio program with me, Scooter. That was Juice Rap News, Netanyahu versus Kerry, with a cameo by the actual real-life Norman Finkelstein. Tonight, we're shouting out to my new pal, Larry Hatton, on death row. Hey, Larry. Hey, I wrote you a letter last week, but my wife caught it on the way to the mailbox and said, you can't send that. You're going to get us on more FBI watch lists. And I'm all like, the statute of limitations is all up on that stuff, but she's the wiser of us, so we'll just have to talk here on the radio where nobody's listening. Anyway, I appreciate your encouraging my misbehavior. Glad I could get you some laughs. I do get frequent letters from the captive audience, but the mass majority are from born-agains who are trying to point out the errors of my ways, which is ironic. But they are trying to save my immortal soul. I just give it to them if they ask nicely. I don't know if you can put your immortal soul in somebody's books, but I don't think I'd buy a toothbrush at this point. It's not even worth a stamp. Anyway, hang in there, buddy. Let me know if I can send you some books or something. Well, I was going to do another morose, heavy anti-war mix tonight because Gaza. That's all I've been doing lately, though, because war. I'm starting to bum myself out, so I'll just make a few comments instead. What's going on in Gaza is shameful and heartbreaking. Throwing bombs into a trapped population, no matter what the excuse. I mean, even forget morality. It doesn't work. It's a dumb move. History is my witness. Your French Revolution gets out of hand, reigns terror, you get a Napoleon. You have a world war, starve and oppress the loser, you get the Nazis. You exploit and rape a subcontinent for a century, you get Mao. Culture of revolutions. Bomb Cambodia into the Stone Age, you get Pol Pot. Oppress the Muslim Brotherhood for decades, they win an election. Belgian king strip mine and murdered Central Africa, we have the Congo. holocaust the Jewish people, and you get a militant, reactionary Zionist regime. And they're all shouting, remember the Alamo. Unleash the dogs of war, and they inevitably bite you in the ass. In the chaos that follows, the lunatics always take over the asylum. And the world stands around bewildered. Hey, we just kicked their asses. Didn't they learn their lesson? Why are they so angry? I don't know. Ask yourself, Israel, why so angry at Hamas? You created them. Oppression and violence breeds rabid nationalist movements that could someday actually gain enough power to kick your ass. Trying to grind people under your boot never pacifies them. You have to outsmart them, you know, like we did with the Marshall Plan. Build them schools and hospitals and infrastructure. You just have to tie the right strings to it. Wrap it up in some phony brotherhood, freedom, and liberty propaganda. If we can get the Japanese playing baseball, you can calm the Palestinians down. You're Jews, for Christ's sakes. You're clever. Start acting like it. All right, coming up, this is from a new video special from Dylan Brody, purveyor of fine words and phrases. This video is called More Arts, Less Marshall. It's a very inexpensive download. Think about, you know, Latte Grande or so. Go to DylanBrody.com for more information. It's spelled Dylan Brody.
Thank you very much and good evening. There's a particular piece that I wish to present this evening. But before I get to this piece, I feel it is helpful if you have a little bit of background information on who I am and what I'm about. When I was an infant, I spiked a very high fever. My parents rushed me to the hospital. I was surrounded by concerned doctors and worried nurses. My grandparents drove up from New Jersey. They gathered in the hospital room. I was packed in ice. I was wrapped in alcohol-soaked sheets. And eventually, my fever broke. There was concern about brain damage. If you ask me, the jury is still out. They wanted to test, but I was an infant. So the doctor could not say, do you know who the president is? Do you know what month it is? And so on. The only way they could test for brain damage was to find out whether I remembered the one trick I had learned up until that point. My mother would say, hooray for Dylan, and I would clap. So my mother said, hooray for Dylan, and I clapped in the room full of worried doctors and concerned nurses and frantic parents and horrified grandparents burst into adoring, relieved laughter and applause. Let us review. My very first social experience on planet Earth was hooray for Dylan, followed by laughter and applause. Surely somewhere in my tiny little prelingual infant brain, I thought, so far, this is going very well. It is the nature of the human experience and operant conditioning that since that time I've been seeking out exactly that sequence of events and then looking for something to suck. Now, when I was about 4 years old, my family moved to a small town in upstate New York called Schuylerville, New York. We drove all night long in a huge pink Plymouth, a vehicle from which, in time of emergency, smaller vehicles could easily be launched. I was young, but my reading skills had already developed to such an extent that as we drove into town, by dawn's first dim pink light, I was able to read the sign that said, "Welcome to Schuylerville, population 954. And to give you a sense of what sort of town this is, that afternoon, the old white-haired mayor himself drove out to the sign with a bucket o' paint and in a Norman Rockwell gesture, because we had moved in, amended the sign to say, "And some Jews." I was raised by academic intellectuals, and I was raised to believe that academic intellectualism was inherently superior to physical prowess of any kind. But in Schuylerville, kids played Little League, so I signed up for Little League. I was not good at Little League. My ability to catch and bat was severely impeded by a tendency to close my eyes and hide my face when a ball came near me. I was assigned to a position called deep left field. It was a position created specifically for me, 40, 50 yards beyond the actual left fielder, where there was no chance I would ever be involved in any of the actual game. I could stand out in the deep weeds and stare at the clouds and imagine the animals. One afternoon, my father came to see me play on a Saturday, and he sat in the bleachers with the other parents, and as so many parents are, he felt compelled to shout encouragement to his son in his endeavors. But he was a teacher of theater and English at a liberal arts college nearby. He was the man from whom I had learned my non-athleticism. He had never internalized phrases like get in the game or keep your eye on the ball. So as I stood out in the deep weeds, swatting at gnats and praying that no ball should ever come to me, I heard my father's voice drifting out over the green as he shouted, "Dylan, leap into the present moment!" And I knew at once that this would be one more reason for my teammates to brutalize and ridicule me. This was not the only place that I was ridiculed and brutalized. I was beaten up regularly on my way home from school. I remember once sitting with my father and saying, "I don't understand why they hate me so much." And he said, "Dylan, they don't hate you. They envy you, your intelligence and your wit and your ability to make your teachers laugh and your good grades and your nonviolent relationship with your parents." He did not explain to me that it wouldn't help to explain this to the bullies. It was more useful than my mother's advice. She said, "Dylan, not everybody you meet in life is going to like you. The sooner you can accept that, the sooner you can stop trying to win my affection." At one point, I sat down with my father on the steps in front of our house, and I said, "Dad, I hate Little League. I hate it. I hate everything about it. I hate the practices, and I hate the riding to and from the park on my bike with the glove, and I hate the games, and I hate the catching and the throwing, and I hate the batting, and the glove makes my hand all sweaty." And he said, "Well, Dylan, I went into the doctor. I said, it hurts when I do this." He said, "Then don't do this." I stared at my father at 11 years old, not yet familiar with rhetorical allegory. And he said, "Dylan, it's an old joke. The point is, you can stop if you want." That thought broke on me like that first burst of cool rain at the end of a long, hot, muggy spell. The idea that I could stop doing that which caused me discomfort and unhappiness. It was my first taste of self-determination. I could quit doing that which caused me displeasure. Oh, I quit Little League. I took up the life of the academic and the intellectual, and I read a lot, and I pretended that I genuinely believed that academic intellectualism was inherently superior to physical prowess of any kind. My father was a fairly good man. He tried hard to teach me things that would be useful. He taught me that it was okay to cry, that it was okay to express my own feelings. But because of who he was, it never occurred to him to teach me that sometimes I would have to be strong, or even that I could. Forgive me, when I perform, I sweat like Rush Limbaugh coming off OxyContin. I have this fear that someone's going to write a review of me saying, "See, Mr. Brody, He's a brilliant storyteller, but see him in a well-ventilated space. Once he sweats through his cologne, he begins to smell like an angry caribou. In order to drag you toward the present at the speed of text, let me offer up some of you, those of you who are familiar with my work, and really who isn't, may have heard this before. If that is the case, I apologize, but I'll try to make it fast. I moved to Los Angeles with $500 in my pocket and a meeting with a producer who said he loved my first screenplay. So on the appointed night, at the appointed time, I went to the Paramount lot and I went to his office where he again told me that he loved my work, but that he could not put down money on the script until I did some rewrites on the third act. So I took some of my $500 and I bought a portable typewriter and I went and stayed on a friend's couch, and during the day I did the rewrite, and on the appointed day, at the appointed time, I showed up on the Paramount lot just in time to find a custodial worker scraping the producer's name off the office door with a razor blade. And my triumphant arrival in the City of Angels was not exactly what I had thought it was going to be, but I was young and I was energetic and I could talk, and I had been a regular at the Improv in New York since the time I was 17, so everything was going to be fine. I went to the Improv on Melrose. And I said, "Hi, I'm a regular at the Improv in New York." And they said, "We don't care. The owner's wife got that one in the divorce." But I was young and I was energetic and I could talk, and I convinced them that they should give me a showcase. And on a Tuesday night, I came into the club. At the appointed time, I went up to the MC and I said, "After this guy is off, I'm going up. Expectations are very important. I want you to tell them that you're very excited to have me here, that I'm a special guest, that I've been in New York, where I was working in the film and television industry." This was all true. I had been a production assistant on Crocodile Dundee, and the Cagney and Lacey New York shoot. I said, "Tell them you're very excited to have me here." And he said, "I know how to do my job, go wait in the back." And I stood in the back of the room as he went on stage and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Hollywood Improv is very proud to present a special guest." And there was a murmur in the room because this was the mid-80s. Ronald Reagan was president, though he did not know it at the time. This was the time during which people came to the Improv specifically to see very special guests that we were excited to have. And he said, "He's been in New York, he's just come back from shooting a major motion picture release." And I said, "Not exactly what I was asked for, but I asked for the right thing, I have plausible deniability." He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm Improv welcome." I shifted my weight forward under the balls of my feet to move toward the stage, as he said, "For Robin Williams." And Robin Williams blasted past me, and he took the stage, and he joked and sweated, and he was hilarious for 45 minutes. And then he said, "Thank you very much, good night," and he came off stage. People signaled their waiters for their checks, and they began to hand in credit cards as the MC went back up on stage and said, "All right, this next guy is from New York. Dylan, why don't you come up and show us what you got?" And I took the stage to a walking ovation, ladies and gentlemen. I told wry political jokes to a group of people that was no longer an audience. They were now just a group bottlenecking at Negress. And my stunning showcase at the Hollywood Improv was not exactly what I had thought it was going to be, but I was young and I was energetic and I could talk. So I went up the street to the Comedy Store, where I got a job answering the phones that paid not enough to rent an apartment. And I answered the phones during the day, and at night I stole stage time at the end of the show if there was any audience left in the room at all. And then I would sleep on the roof of the club in a space that I found out one rainy night was designed to channel water away from an entrance. So I found old newspapers and I dammed up a little dry space for myself, and from then on, if it looked like rain, I hid out in the club till all the doors were locked, and then I slept on a booth upstairs in the belly room, the small development room for newbies, because I had so thoroughly internalized the psychotic status system of this club that even as a vagabond, I didn't feel I was ready for the main room. And one night, I stole stage time at the end of a show. And afterwards, a woman came up to me and told me that she thought I was very funny. And she invited me to her home in the Hollywood Hills, where I had sex with her and her boyfriend, because they gave me a lot of cocaine and hinted at a guest house I might be able to stay in. And that night, as I walked the long, winding, dark road back down to the club, I was incredibly happy, partly because They'd given me a lot of cocaine. And mostly because she had said that I was funny. And it didn't occur to me until many years later that I had been homeless and a prostitute. But that night, as I went to sleep in my little tar paper rain gutter depression, it did occur to me that adulthood was not going exactly the way I had thought it was going to be. But I was young and I was energetic, and over time I got more work on the road. I began to open for people and then to feature for people, and all over the country I took the stage in double-breasted false bravado, and I prayed that the audience would not see through my wardrobe and my wit to realize that I was a fake and a fraud, that I was a freak and a phony. And I was not George Carlin, and I was not Bill Hicks, and I was not Lenny Bruce, and my firm commitment to the truth was not exactly what I had thought it was going to be. And after the shows, I would work the crowds, or I would go to the local bars to try to find women who might indulge my dark fetishes and personal perversities, and failing to find them, I would weep alone in stoned hotel rooms, and I was not James Bond, and I was not Hawkeye Pierce, and my psychosexual persona was not exactly what I had thought it was going to be. And then, one night, I went into a coffee house and I met this woman. She was managing the coffee house, and I flirted with her, and it worked. And I hung out late into the night, and she kept refilling my cup, and we talked, and we laughed. And finally, I asked her out on a date, and she said yes. And that night, as I drove back to my little studio apartment, I realized that I could imagine spending a lifetime with this woman. But I knew that eventually she would find out who I was, and that I had this past, and that I was a freak and a fraud and a fake and a phony, and she would walk away, or keep it a secret, and there would be a dark cloud of deception hanging over the relationship. And that night, as I went to sleep on my sweat-soaked futon on the floor, I made a decision. And when I went on our first date, I showed up dragging a duffel bag full of coke whore shame and pushing my self-loathing in front of me like a shopping cart full of obsolete rain-soaked newspapers. And in between the appetizer and the main course, I unloaded all my baggage on the table. And this woman is amazing. Well, this woman whose only flaw is that she turns the map to face the same direction that we're traveling. Reached across the table and scratched the side of my head like I was a big sheepdog and said, "You're just a little freak, aren't you?" And I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, the first 17 years of marriage have not been exactly what I thought they were going to be. They've been much better. Thank you.
Dylan Brody from his just-released video download, More Arts, Less Marshall. Go to dylanbrody.com to hook up and support a very unique talent. This and all previous Innerside Radio programs have a right to exist on the internet. Simply drop a Google bomb on The Innerside. You can't miss it. It's right next to the Terrace Grade School. My name is Scooter, and I'll see y'all next week.
Down with disease, and I'm up before the dawn. A thousand people, children outside.